You're listening to the Washington Hospitality Industry Podcast, your primary source of information related to the hospitality industry in Washington State.
Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Hospitality Profit. We have Rick Braw with us today. He's a financial consultant, and he's also a member of our advisory network. As a member, you're entitled to 30-minute consultations complimentary from any one of the members of our advisory network. And if you would like to do that, go ahead and reach out to your territory manager, and they can put you in touch with the right person. While we're waiting for people to come in, remember, we've got a number of other webinars coming up, not this week, but the week after. We have a webinar with the Department of Health to discuss the Certified Food Protection Manager requirement, along with the person in charge and the difference between those two and what you need to know to demonstrate knowledge. Also with that, we also have a webinar with Catherine Morissette coming up on April 10th. All of these webinars are at 10 a.m., by the way, and Catherine is going to talk about pay transparency and what you need to have listed in your job postings online and in public. Okay, and now today we have Rick Braw, and along with him, Lex Nepomuceno, our Senior Director of Communications. And if you have any questions for them along the way, go ahead and type them into the Q&A section on your Zoom screen, and we can answer those live on air. So good morning, everyone.
Good morning. I think she just disappeared, Lex.
let's go ahead and get started.
Okay. Yeah, I'll go ahead and disappear and you guys can do your thing.
All right, great. Lex, you want to launch off at all?
This is going to be my last webinar with the association and moving on to do my own gig, but it's been a pleasure working with you over the years, Rick, and I hope to continue working with you in some capacity in the future, and you've been a mentor for me as well as other members of the organization, so nice to see that we're going to go out with a bang, as we have a couple hundred people registered for this one. This might be the biggest Rick Braw webinar yet.
That's awesome. Great. And I want to encourage all of you that are on the webinar to make sure that you always attend Catherine's sessions. It's rare to get an attorney to do a webinar, and it's a rare opportunity to be able to ask questions of somebody of her caliber. So make sure you attend that next week. All right. So as Lex and Lisa mentioned, my name is Rick Braw. I run a company called AMP Services. So we do accounting, management, and professional services for primarily multi-unit restaurant companies. So we have a ton of data. We have about 250 restaurants in about 26 states. So we have a lot of compilation that we put the numbers together. So when I speak, you know that it's got some background behind it. All right. So, you know, this is kind of the blinding flash of the obvious for me over the last probably couple of months. You know, who makes money in the location? I grew up in, in restaurants, served until I was in my late 20s, got my degree, went to Restaurants Unlimited, worked in the accounting department, helped build a lot of the systems and tools for the restaurants. But ultimately, only people making money are the people running the locations, nobody else. It's 15 minutes of time. We can give you all the tools, all the data, all the fancy systems that you ever want. But if you don't make those great decisions every 15 minutes, or in some cases, even quicker than that, then no one makes money. So managers are the ones that make the money. And the question is, are you making enough money to be happy? Because ultimately, you should be sharing in that as a business partner. And the more money that the owners make, the more likelihood there is some money to share there. I'm really big on that. You know, statistics show that about profitability goes up about 40%, not 40 points, about 40% with a profit sharing program. And we've seen that firsthand. So you want to make sure that you're making lots of money for the operators, because they want to share that and keep you around. All right. So first thing to do around restaurant P&Ls and financial management is to make sure you build a regular financial routine. So it's got to be, the information has to be accurate, has to be timely, and it has to be relevant. Getting your P&L 3 weeks later isn't going to do you any favors. So you want to make sure that you have that information every day, in some cases, every week, and every period that you can access and that you can communicate back to your team. And that's really the biggest thing, because you want active management on the floor, and really turning all the servers, the bartenders, the cooks, the prep people into owners of the restaurant, making things personally important to them, posting goals on whiteboards, and making sure that you're talking to your team at least every week and setting targets for the upcoming week. So make sure that at the end of the period that you're meeting with your team and reviewing the results, and then decide, you know, around sales specifically, do you have a guest traffic issue? Do you have a guest average issue? Is there an efficiency issue? Do you have more than that? And then solving those problems every week. So the biggest switch that you can make in your mindset is really to be a person of planning and forecasting as a manager, both front and back. Without it, you're going to fail. If you're constantly looking back, you're going to fail. You're just going to inherit the results you get. And in some cases, sales are so good, it's fine. But sooner or later, and especially in 2024, sales are turning around. So traffic has dropped off dramatically nationwide, even worldwide. When I look at the OpenTable data, we've got some serious problems. You know, Seattle alone was down 11% in January, according to OpenTable, 4% in February, and down about 3% in March so far. So we've lost a lot of traffic, and we've raised prices a lot. So those guest counts are down, or the guest is really managing their guest check. So we need to make sure that we're planning more aggressively than ever, and really looking at bodies and hours and counts and how the business is developing. So I've got a buddy that is a firefighter, and he wrote the documentation for evacuating the Columbia Tower. Now imagine in an 80-floor, 100-floor skyscraper, if you had no plan to get people out of the building, what a disaster that would be. So being proactive around planning and forecasting is applicable across the board. Doesn't matter what industry it is, but it's really about looking forward. So once you can look forward, you've got a plan, you can really dominate those costs. So running the business forward, I've said this for years, is the number one job of the manager. Inheriting results is a recipe for failure in a down year. And I really think that 2024 is going to be a really tough year for our industry. It's not starting off well. Our portfolio is down. Everybody else's portfolio is down. We've got some bright spots, but not enough. So I think we really need to be focused on the year of productivity and managing every single minute and in 15-minute increments. So make sure, you know, that you're peaking the peak when you're doing your staffing, when you're forecasting, because all the time I see this whole thing of, well, people are going off at 2 o'clock and people are coming in at 2 o'clock and you're peaking staffing levels. It's like dinner, you know, doesn't come in for 3.5 hours after that. You've used all your money halfway through the day. So move that prep forward and peak the peak closer to your sales peak. So make sure those are overlapping your sales and your staffing. So most importantly, discuss everything with your team. Like I said, post things on a whiteboard, talk about it at your management team meetings every week, look at your goal, look at your budget, look at your standards, and then use that for purchasing and scheduling, because it's got to tie in to how you're buying product and how you're scheduling people.
Got a question.
All right. So first, yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
What is a reasonable expectation of EBITDA for a family casual dining restaurant doing $3 million in net sales?
Oh, that's a great question. That's at the very end of the presentation. I always like to set at least 15%. You've got to work that way. And the pushback that I'm going to get is, well, labor cost is really expensive now. Well, We just need to be more aggressive around that, and we need to be more aggressive around product cost. Those two areas are where we really need to make sure that we're managing every dollar, every cent, every hour, and every minute that goes by. And then don't forget about the middle of the P&L. So we're going to kind of work our way through there. So sales mix is the first area that I look at on the P&L. So if we look at this particular P&L, and don't slaughter me on the numbers that I'm going through here, because this is just a fraction of one of the locations that we have, just a little bit of scrubbed up data. So I'm only using $1.5 million because the average restaurant in Washington State does about $1 million a year. So I've taken it down from a $4.5 million restaurant or a $3 million restaurant down to $1.5 million, just to look at that for some highlights. So the first place I look on the P&L is really in sales mix. And people go to restaurants to eat. The incremental sale is to drink. So we need to sell more beverage on an active basis. That means speed to the table, getting the order in, getting that drink on the table, even before you've even taken the order, the food order. So making sure you're quick to the table to build that beverage sales. That you can see in this particular concept, which is a beer-heavy concept, that they are very quick to the table and their food sales are only about half the P&L. Typically, we see somewhere about 75 to 80% of sales being food. So the goal is really to get that down to 70-30 and ultimately 65-35, like a lot of the celebrity chefs are in that category there. So really five ways to build sales. It used to be four. I think there's really five now. Getting new guests. Now, the new guests represent about 20 to 40% of your sales. And our whole job with new guests is to identify them, reward them, and get them to come back. And it takes four perfect visits in a row to get them to become a regular. And once you get them to be a regular, they'll bring their friends and their family in. And then you can work on converting them. We're going to talk about that in a little bit. Getting people to come back is frequency. About 60 to 80% of your sales come from the same people over and over and over. You want to make sure that you're moving those regular guests in and out at the pace that they want and giving them the control that they want of their experience. Building the check average, I think we got to be really careful this year. I think we build it through providing more value through the menu. That would be, you know, additional beverage sales, which we're really seeing, honestly, the first quarter. Beverage is really lagging. I don't know if it's, you know, dry uary and all the different, you know, sober curious and all of that kind of thing that's driving that. But beverage is really down in this first quarter, at least in our portfolio, and I think industry-wide too. So we've got to make sure that we're really pushing that and getting it out there, and that's really speed to the table and speed on that second drink. So events are the other one that you can build. We're not going to see, I don't think in 2024, these gigantic, you know, 100, 200 person parties. I think we're going to see a lot more 10 and 20 person parties. As big companies are laying off, the last thing they want to do is throw a party for 100 people and spend, you know, $50,000 to $100,000 on it. So I think we're going to see a lot more sales. And that, honestly, is going to push the industry down. I think there's always going to be at the high end. The very wealthy companies that can afford to do the high-end steakhouses and things like that. But I think people are going to look for, companies are going to look for alternatives. And the key to that, honestly, is making sure you answer the phone and get right back to people, because they will move on in a matter of about 1 hour. So I call you, I got your voicemail, you don't call me back, I'm on to the next person. And guess what? That next company is going to take that sale, and that you don't want that to be you. And then the last area is really third party platforms. We kind of poo-poo them, but I watch it all the time as a third party platform orderer. You know, I went to order a couple $100 worth of dinner the other night, and they said they couldn't accommodate. So guess what? I used another restaurant and they lost a $200 sale. If they would have done that five times in the night, they lost $1,000. $365,000, let's say $360,000 a year, they just lost because they couldn't produce at the right time. So make sure that you're forecasting all of that in for your staffing as well. So as I mentioned, traffic is really going to be the key to 2024. driving traffic. Speed is the master. If I can depend on you to come into your restaurant and get out on my time frame, which is about 70 minutes or less, I'm going to keep coming back. You slow me down. If you're, you know, if you're an upscale restaurant, obviously it's going to take a little bit longer for an experience. But for me to go to a regular casual dining restaurant, I don't want to spend a bunch of time, neither do you. And I want to be in control. And too often I'm held hostage by the last 10 to 20 minutes of getting the check and getting checked out. So making sure that speed to the table, get that drink on the table, speed out of the kitchen. As a kitchen manager, your whole thing has to be 12 minute or better ticket times. So you've got to figure out how to get that food out of the kitchen quickly. So speed is the master and the key ingredient to everything. And then getting the guest through, because nobody wants to be on a wait anymore. Just move them through. Get that table reset in 2 minutes. Get that food out in 12 minutes. Get that drink on the table within 2 minutes. Get that second drink on the table within the first 20 minutes. So speed and throughput are the key to this year. And start everybody fast. Don't start people at the beginning of their shift and have them standing around or being slow. They'll never hit their groove. And I know that from experience. From years and years of working in restaurants, you start slow, you stay slow, you start fast, you stay fast. And we want to start fast and stay fast. All right, so building traffic every guest, every time. My pet peeve in restaurants is there's a table of four and we serve two. The two on the outside or the two that we think are at least one that's going to pay the check. And we need to serve all four people at a four top, six people at a six top, two people at a two top, obviously one at a one. So we want to serve and connect with every single guest every time. And then from the kitchen and from the bar, serve excellent product that you would like at home. Too often we send out just another plate of food or another drink, and we're not looking at it as though somebody's going to eat that or drink it and consume it. And we have to keep that running the kitchen and running the front of the house. This is somebody's meal. This isn't just another customer or another guest. It's somebody's meal. And this is all they're going to have for that meal period. So we have to send out excellent product, just like you would if you had company at your house, and making sure from the kitchen that you realize it's not just a plate of food. But back when I cooked, I used to look at the guest and look them in the eye and think, you know, I'm making your food for you. And years ago, when I talked to Matt Dillon, he used to be kind of a celebrity chef in town, ran Sick and Spruce and a number of other restaurants. You know, he said, when we first started the restaurant, I would just go on the walk-in and I would get some food and I'd just cook for you. And I think we need to get, you know, it's more polished than that now, but we need to get back to that whole idea of I'm cooking for you. This is a really special job. Being in the kitchen is really special. And the ability to provide somebody a nutritious meal or a great burger or whatever it is, really a privilege. So we want to make sure that we're serving excellent product, just like you would at home, just like you had company at home, and create those regulars, because we know that 60 to 80% of them are the ones that pay all of our sales, and we want to spoil them rotten. We also want to take our loyalty to the next level, to know the guest inside and out, because they spend at a premium. An average engaged guest spends at a 15% premium compared to a 13% discount for a first timer or somebody that doesn't know your concept. That's a 28-point swing. That's huge. Huge. We want to keep them coming back over and over and over because they're the ones that spread the word. And as you see that bullet point there, 92% of people trust word of mouth. They don't trust advertising. You don't trust anything on TV or through the radio or anything like that. You know, we don't trust it. That's like 20 to 30% at the most. 92%. I tell my friend, I love this place. Guess what? They're going to go. They're going to go. 92% trust word of mouth. So the big benefit, according to the loyalty line around loyalty, is you stop competing on price. You can retain the guests, you increase the lifetime value, and you build those personal relationships that everybody likes. And then people repeat word of mouth. They bring people in. And the last bullet point on there, my personal favorite, is really to treat the to-go and the third party like dining guests. Do something special for them. Don't treat them like they're annoying. I know it's annoying at times to get an order in the middle of the dinner rush, and all of a sudden it interrupts the flow of the kitchen, but it's not going away. So we really need to have SOPs around that. We need to integrate those guests, and then we need to convert them to regular guests. Do a great job every time and be glad you got those sales. All right, so back to basics here. Lisa, do you have a question?
Yes. We have a question. How can you manage quality of to-go orders that inevitably decrease in quality while boxed up, waiting for the customer to pick up, and the time to transport, to transport to their home? How do you best execute guest recovery for those who are disappointed with the quality of the takeout order?
Yeah. So food, you know, food's cheap, right? I mean, it doesn't seem like it is, but I'm getting recovering a guest from that is extremely important. So having the stamp on the outside of the bag, obviously sealing it up, maybe even a little note in there saying, hey, call me if you're not happy with the quality of the product, because we really want to convert them into regular guests. And nobody does that. Nobody does that. No one's putting a little note in there and saying, hey, your food was produced at such and such a time. It was hot, fresh, ready to go. You know, contact whatever delivery service if you didn't get it, you know, within a reasonable amount of time, and contact us because we'd love to help you have a better experience. So I think that's a big deal around guest recovery, is really connecting with the guest, because it's the delivery service that causes the problem in my experience most of the time. We make the food very quickly. We put it on a rack or wherever it goes. And then they don't come and pick it up for, you know, 30 minutes to an hour. And then tracking those measurements with the third-party delivery services and holding them accountable to that. And getting credits back from them if they're not doing their job. Because you want to be able to provide, ultimately, the guests with that experience, the great experience. Because it's not your fault. It's 99% of the time, it is the delivery service. And so you want to prevent any kind of disconnect with the client, because they always blame it on the restaurant. That's the number one complaint. They blame it on the restaurant. They run down your review. The food wasn't good. And back to that question about what do you do about food that doesn't travel well? Don't sell it. You know, if you got an item like, let's say, for example, grilled cheese with French fries, that's going to be terrible. Absolutely terrible, unless you figure out how to take the moisture out of things along the way. It's going to be a terrible product, so don't sell it. What are those items that you absolutely have to sell? And then how do you tweak them in the recipe to be able to sell it appropriately? But don't sell items you know don't travel well.
We have two questions. What if it's the guest pickup and not third-party delivery? It's the same question both times.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. And I think labeling the bag and making sure that they know that that product was ready. Pizza is a great game, right? We order the pizza. We don't pick it up for 15, 20 minutes later. It's stuck to the bottom of the box. It's degraded product. I mean, there are times that you might want to just ask them, hey, this isn't going to be very good. I've seen that before with some really, really great operators. Is this pizza is not going to be very good. You know, you want to hang out for another 3 minutes. Let me throw a fresh one in, because it costs you, what, $2? And then they get a hot, fresh product that they love to death. And hopefully they don't do the same thing next time, because they realize that, you know, this costs you money to do. But really being on top of that, as opposed to, well, you suck. You showed up 45 minutes late, taking care of the guests, just like you would at home. You know, somebody's running late. You're going to figure out how to take care of that product. You're not going to just say, well, you know, sorry you were late. Your dinner sucks now. So a couple of great questions there. All right. So let's talk about cost of goods sold. Let's make sure everybody's on the same page to compute cost of goods sold. We take beginning inventory plus purchases minus end inventory. And then for percentage, we divide that by whatever category It is. So in this particular example, we've got food costs at 29.3%. So we have 224,000. The previous page showed the sales for food, 766,000. Unfortunately, I see a lot of P&Ls from people, you know, that are trying to control their product costs that divide it by total sales. And it's got to be category by category. Food by food, beer by beer, liquor by liquor, wine by wine. It can't be by total. You never solve a problem by that. It's just too wild of a swing. Your sales mix, that's why I started with sales mix. If that sales mix changes and you compute things by total sales, and food sales as a percentage goes down, but beverage goes up, your food cost is gonna get better. And it doesn't make any sense. So you want food to food, beer to beer, wine to wine, liquor to liquor, mixer I typically do of liquor sales. And then NA, hopefully you've got an NA category, either in food or beverage. Some people like it in food, some people like it in beverage. Typically quick service is in food. And full service can be in beverage because it gets mixed up with bar mixer a lot of times. So in this particular case, we have 29.3% food cost. So you need to know what that number is for your restaurant. And the best way to get a baseline is take the last, if you're on a calendar, take the last 12 months. If you're on a period, take the last 13 periods. If you're on 4, 4, 5, take the last 12 periods. But look at that number on an annual basis, because if you lose your entire inventory, it's not going to change that number that much, unless you've got a gigantic inventory and you go from 30,000 to zero overnight. You want to make sure that you look at that annual number. Anything less, you're doing better if it's consistent. Anything more, you're doing worse. And that's the one number that I look at, is that trailing 13 or trailing year data. That's the right number. It takes all the anomalies and inventory variances out, purchasing, all sorts of mistakes that eliminate. And that is the number you look at and say, am I doing better or worse than that?
So we have another question. Will you be able to share food costs by market segment for us by your experience?
Oh, sure. Yeah. We're talking about QSR and full service steakhouses, that kind of thing. Yeah, so QSR, you're going to see, you know, typically low to mid 20s. The casual dining, you're going to see mid 20s to 30, hopefully. And steakhouses are really, really different. They go from 28 to 38, sometimes 39%. The difference in somebody that has a really high food cost is they have a low labor cost because their check average is so high, and typically vice versa. That's why we're looking at prime costs, and we're going to get there in a couple of slides. We want to look at prime costs as the whole. You know, what's it cost to make this product, along with what's it cost to sell the product. So those items, you know, pizza, 18 to 22%. Why everybody loves pizza. A lot of money in pizza, provided you can drive the sales. Great product too. Everybody loves it. So it's either number one or number two in sales in the industry.
And then,
but glad to answer. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Then there's the same question, but for labor costs, breaking out manager costs.
Yeah. Yeah. So labor costs, we're going to get to after the cost of goods, but typically you want that labor cost plus or minus 30. And what we're seeing in Seattle is plus or minus 40. So we have to figure that part of it out. That's where we need to perhaps change the model and really watch the staffing levels, but often it's landing in the mid 30s. That's why we have to push the cost of goods towards the low 20s, which means you need to sell more beverage, because food is more expensive than beverage, typically more expensive than beverage. So we want to make sure that you have a good mix, and we want to see that prime cost, the combination of the two, at 60%. You get over 60, you're not going to make any money. And that's where a lot of people are at right now. You hit 70% in prime costs, you're dead. You're going to bleed. There's just not enough left to pay off. And we're going to get to that here in a little bit. So when we look at food costs, just food costs, first of all, you have to know your ideal cost. So you have to take, let's say, your top 80% of sellers, which is typically your top 20 items. You plug in your velocities, hopefully for the last year, you've got that data. How many numbers did I sell? What's the selling price? What was the cost? There's my actual cost. You total it all up. You add a waste factor of, let's say, 10%, not 10 points, 10%. So if you're running a 25, you'd say I should be running a 27.5. Or if I'm running a 20, I should be running a 22 or 30, a 33. So we want to make sure that you add a little bit of variance and waste in there for that ideal. But you need to know what your cost is, because I'm going to show you at the bottom with this little chart here what the issues are. So make sure that you've got great purchasing. So half of your problems, half of the problems with food costs come in the blue. Purchasing, I bought too much, I threw it away, I didn't receive the right product, I didn't store it properly, I've got things sitting behind other products, I didn't do label date rotate. So half of your problems come from then. The second half of your problems come from when you take it out to the prep table and you sell it to the guest. And I'm getting more and more convinced all the time that it's actually greater than 50%. Because if you look at and you say, let's just use a kind of a silly example. Let's say you're supposed to serve a 6-ounce burger and you're doing hand-formed patties. And somebody screws up and makes 8-ounce burgers, not six-ounce burgers compared to 8-ounce burgers, you're wasting 2 ounces of burger on every burger you sell. That's in the production and the selling side. And you can't recover that. It's already gone. It's already eaten. It's already sold. So you can't recover that. So making sure that your portions are correct is absolutely critical. And that your items are priced correctly. That's the engineering side. Sometimes you're gonna have something that's a higher percentage that you sell more of, but at least make sure that it's priced correctly in the POS, because we've seen a lot of mistakes in the POS over the last, 75 years. So we often don't check those prices carefully enough. Whenever I'm out, I check the prices to the menu price, and then I'll circle it. I'll write a little note to the manager and say, hey, make sure that you check the price of this item because you're off by $2. Happens all the time. Every day it happens in restaurants. So half of the problems are making sure that you've got the right amount, that you're buying the right amount, not wasting it. And then the other half is I got to make sure that I'm producing things properly. And then lastly, making sure that you're actually counting things properly. That we can't solve any problems if that's not done correctly. So if you look at without an inventory adjustment, people are like, why do I have to take inventory? Well, let's say your food purchases were $30,000 for the month. Your food sales were $100,000. You had a 30% food cost. You didn't count inventory whatsoever. You just used purchases. With inventory, let's say that you bought 30, you ended with 10. You had a beginning inventory of 10. You had an ending inventory of 15. You had a food cost of $25,000 because you didn't use $5,000 worth of that purchases. So you had $100,000 worth of food sales. Your food cost is really 25%. And we can't, and this is the frustrating part of being above store, we can't solve any problems without consistent, good inventory counts with good prices attached to those. Those have to be accurate. So those that do count properly win. And those that don't, all they have is reasons, stories, and excuses. One month, they're the hero of the month. The next month, they're the GOAT. Not the GOAT, greatest of all time, but the one that gets kicked in the butt. So reason, story, and excuses, and it's up and down. I feel great this month, though. It's bad the next, so on and so forth. Making sure you're counting accurate inventory is going to straighten that out. Then we can solve problems. If the inventory is accurate, we say, okay, do we have a price that's not correct? Are we getting a product that we shouldn't be getting? Are we selling too much of a certain product and we need to maybe move it around on the menu? But we can solve problems once we have the accurate data.
Got a couple more questions for you.
Yeah.
How do you calculate your cost on liquor? Do you include the alcohol tax and the cost of the item, or segregate it out to a separate tax line? Their system
is
the latter, so we manually add the tax back into the item, but that's, is that the norm?
Yep, that's the way that we do it. The way that is the norm. You want fully loaded cost.
And how frequently should you count your inventory? Monthly, weekly?
Yeah, great question. So I grew up in the weekly system, so counting it every week. And then we switched to monthly down towards the end of my tenure with Restaurants Unlimited. But if that number slips three periods in a row, you had to go back to counting weekly inventory. Proteins, you want to count those big high-end proteins every day and reconcile those back out. You want to do the high-end proteins because they have a propensity to walk. And as I've mentioned before, the more inventory you have, the more inventory that walks. So you want those inventory counts to be low because they're quick to count. You also don't want to have more than about 3 to 5 days of food inventory on hand. We've seen this over and over and over, that just in time, that goes back to planning and forecasting. Planning and forecasting accurately, scheduling your purchases accurately, allows you to keep a lower inventory, believe it or not. Because more inventory means more waste or sloppy, being sloppy. And I've always used the analogy of toothpaste, right? You get down to the bottom of the tube, you're very, very careful with it. And then you get a new tube and you're not as careful. You'll spill it in the sink, you don't care. I've got lots of it, not a big deal. But getting down to the bottom of a tube, you wanna preserve that. You'll squeeze every ounce out of it. Case in point, sitting in a restaurant, watching the bartender serving a young lady a glass of wine, and gets down to the bottom of the bottle, looks at it, and then tips it over, out goes an extra 2 ounces. Because he had another bottle sitting there, as opposed to, I'm going to make sure that I've got the right pour every single time all the way through the bottle, and I'm not going to waste 2 ounces at the bottom. I'm going to make sure that I've got the right pours. So having very little inventory on hand, just in time, so full beverage inventory, I don't like to see more than 30 days of cost. So let's go back up to this just so I can illustrate this. So if I had a cost of $224,000, that is about $4,000 a week, right? So I wouldn't want, let me see here, $224 divided by 52 is right around $4,000 a week, right? So I wouldn't want more than about $4,000 or $5,000 with the inventory, food inventory on hand for this. So I want to keep it nice and tight. And I'm telling you, over and over and over, we have seen people that have the smallest amount of inventory just right are the ones that run the very best cost.
So one of our questions is, they have read that you should have 1 week of purchases in-house. What is proper?
Yeah, so that's fine. As far as the food goes, I like closer to 3 to 5 days. 7 days is really acceptable, particularly if you're in a remote area. Might even go to 10. So you got a restaurant in Hawaii, you can't get food over there all the time, you're gonna run a higher inventory. It's just the way it is. You're out in the middle of nowhere in the state of Washington, you're gonna run a higher inventory. The broadliners don't go over there as much. So you have to manage that by location where you're at. But if you're around the city, you're close to, the Puget Sound area, 3 to 5 days, that's it. I don't like to see much more than that. So, you do a $50,000 a week to $2.5 million restaurant, harkening back to the original question, and it's 80% of it is food, you're at 40,000, you got a 30% food cost, you're at $12,000 worth of food cost. I would like to see you carry no more than about $6,000 or $7,000 worth of inventory. Really about how much does your food cost you every week? And then basically cut it in half. And that would be the minimum. You don't want to go too lean. You get below three, you start end up paying more because you've got your vendors coming too much, or you run into the store, which is one of my pet peeves, is running into the store as a manager, because you're really losing your time to manage those 15-minute increments.
When doing inventory.
All right, turning. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we still got some more questions for you. When doing inventory, do you recommend counting prep product as well, or just items as they were purchased?
Yeah, great question. So I grew up in the system where if there was an ant butt on the ground, you counted it. So prep product can really be an issue, particularly if you take inventory. Let's say that you take inventory on a Wednesday, because you're a Wednesday to Tuesday of fiscal week, and you've got parties coming in that you had to prep for on Tuesday. So you've got a lot of prep product because you're busier on Wednesday than you are on Tuesday. Maybe you're not even open. And that can really throw off your numbers. So I like counting prep product, but you have to cost it out is the only downfall. But if you have the proper amount of shelf life, you know how much that's going to be. You know, you're going to have one sheet pan of coleslaw or whatever you're going to prep. So if you do a great job of forecasting, counting that problem shouldn't be a big deal, but it really smooths out your food cost if you count prep. Otherwise, again, you're going to end up with freezer storage and say, well, I had a whole bunch I had to prep. I had to make crab cakes for that big party we had on Wednesday. And I didn't get to count those in inventory. I bought the products, but I made the products. I prepped the crab cakes, but I didn't get to count it in the inventory. So I like counting it, honestly. It smooths things out.
Yeah, we have a comment that prepped or not prepped, it's more important to be consistent in counting.
Yeah, 100%.
And then the last question we have for right now, where's paper cost calculated for QSR food?
QSR typically goes into food cost. And, you know, it's unfortunate how expensive that stuff is. You know, full service has gotten a little bit of taste of QSR's misery around paper cost as we continue to grow the to-go food. So now people are complaining in full service about how expensive it is for those paper products. And for full service, we don't inventory those. So unless you're carrying a gigantic amount of inventory in quick service, I really wouldn't worry about it, but it's expensive. And typically it goes into food costs. Especially if you're wrapping everything, you know, you're doing burgers and you're wrapping everything, it goes into food cost. All right, let's turn to labor. So we'll have lots more here now. Don't crucify me on the numbers here, because again, I took the numbers and I divided them up because first comment's going to be, well, look at those manager salaries at 55. Nobody makes 55 anymore. No, but they might make combination might be 165,000 if we're doing three times the amount. So don't crucify me on the numbers here. Just take a look at the percentages as you will and kind of think about your own concept. So back of the house in this particular model is based on total sales, not food sales, because if it was food sales, back to that 51% sales mix, you'd be looking at about a 15% back of the house labor. So that excludes the kitchen manager down here. So that would be added back in if you like to do it that way. So around labor costs, make sure that you're managing productivity. That's the biggest thing, because we get caught up in percentages and we don't match productivity. And it's really nowadays, because people make so much money, you know, cook costs $27 an hour. A couple of years ago, they were like 17. Or a few years ago. And now we're looking at, you know, people that are making a lot of money per hour. And we want to make sure that they're really productive because the labor percentages are losing a little bit of meaning as we go forward because they're making so much more money, it can kind of throw those things out of whack. So making sure that you track your sales per labor hour on the total, as well as your food sales per labor hour. A lot of people don't do that. But looking, is your kitchen getting more or less productive? And then chart your sales and then make sure your staffing is every 15 minutes. I don't know why we have a habit of bringing people in. Okay, well, your shift starts at 4. Well, when's the business there? Well, we don't start dinner really until 5:30. Well, bring them in at 4:45. Is there a rule that says you have to do it on the half hour or the hour? bring people in on that 15 minutes if you want. It saves a lot of money. If you think about every single day, just saving a little bit, you save 1 hour a day, it's almost $30. $30 a day is almost $11,000 a year. And we've got to get in the habit of, how do we find $30 today? How do we find $60 today? How do we find $90 today? And it's by those 15-minute increments. One of our groups call them 15-minute wins. We want to win every day, beginning and end of the shift. When it drops, and if you're a great manager, there is a pop in the air when the shift, when the rush is over. We all know it. It's all intuitive. It's a weird thing. You can't physically hear it, but you can physically feel it. The rush is over. There's a pop. And I think it's about menus down and all of that kind of thing. But we know. And at that point, boom, you got to cut. You got to start prepping, turning tables over, getting ready to go. But analyzing your data, and there's so many great tools on the market to be able to forecast now. You know, we've got AI that stepped in, that we have tools that basically you can, it'll tell you what your forecast is supposed to be. It looks around the area and says, hey, we got a concert in the area. It's Taylor Swift, but Taylor Swift doesn't go to your restaurant. Those people don't go to your restaurant, or whatever location it is. Here's the bump in your sales when you have a concert, or the Kraken are in town and your sales are going to go up because hockey fans love your restaurant. So we have AI tools that can look at that. They can look at weather. You know, Seattle's very weather driven. If you look at any kind of sales charts of a Seattle restaurant, or a restaurant in Western Washington, even Eastern Washington, it is like the silhouette of Mount Rainier. Really, really heavy in the summer. And those other parts are the ones that really bite you. You know you're going to be busy in the summer if it's a nice day, but having a tool to help you is really critical at this juncture.
I have another question for you. How are your payroll tax expenses so low? Same for unemployment taxes and PTO.
Well, that's about right. I mean, unemployment taxes have grown thanks to the pandemic. Those are, you know, hovering more about a point. These are not against labor numbers. These are against sales. So that 3-4% payroll tax would be taxes on tips and taxes on your labor dollars. But that would be about right. Payroll related, that can really jump around, especially if you've got health insurance. I've just got this on here for modeling purposes, but that's about right. I mean, if you look at it and you say, okay, we've got 25% roughly, right? And a 5%. So we're looking at a 20% load. A 20% load's really typical. And by that, I mean taking your total labor here, adding it all up, and then saying, if I applied 20% for taxes and benefits, I'd come out with this number. So that's 1, 2, 3, 360. So we look at a 20% load on that, about $75,000. That's just about right. Now, the argument's going to be up in here, right? This is where the big argument comes from. Can you really manage to these numbers? Yes, we see them every, we see them every day. Great operators, they manage their front and their back maniacally. And the big argument I get about the back is, if I cut somebody's hours, they're going to quit. I don't like to cut hours from people. I like to cut minutes. Front of the house is easy. That's linear. Business isn't there. Those people don't want to be there. Maybe the front desk wants to hang around a little bit, but nobody wants to be there when it's not busy in the front. Kitchen needs their hours. They don't have a bunch of tips they're living off. They're not making $75 an hour. They're making 30. So they need their hours. So the way to do that is to reduce minute segments, right? To manage their minutes, not cut shifts. And that is a cardinal sin that we see all the time, is people cut shifts out rather than cutting hours out and minutes every day. So the other thing is, if you have an upswing in sales, don't lose it all. Don't go dollar for dollar. Oh, we had $10,000 more, or we had, let's say, $2,000 more in sales yesterday, but we spent $2,000 more in labor. There should be incremental savings there. And that incremental in the front is about 2.5%, and the back should be about 5%. And if it's not too much of a jump. A lot of times we see dollar for dollar in the kitchen saved. In other words, no incremental costs. We're just busier.
What AI tools have you been working with?
There's a few. I can go offline and give some more. Obviously, we don't want to provide any endorsements at this time, especially if they don't work. It's fairly new technology. But there's some cool stuff out there. I'm so glad to hook up around that. The biggest thing about labor is making sure that you cost your schedule, and then you measure your actual versus your schedule. Most people don't do that. The day just goes right by, and they didn't even think. Yesterday, I said I was going to spend X amount of dollars, and I spent Y, and they don't look at it, or hours, they don't look at it. So making sure every single day that you cost your schedule out, how many hours, what's the dollar amount, then you look at your actual versus your schedule. And then the other thing is you should have grids. You know, here's a $10,000 week, here's a $15,000 week, here's a $100,000 week, whatever those measurements are for your particular concept, to know what your schedule should be. Then template wise, you can just drop it in and you're done. Okay, it's going to be a $50,000 week. That should hit. We should have this much in kitchen labor. We should have this much in front of the house labor. You just drop the names in after that. Get the aces in places. If it's a busy day, make sure you've got your best people on. And the last point on there is overtime is not your enemy. Now, don't abuse it, because I had one group saying, well, you told us to, use overtime. Use it wisely. It's your friend. Reward people with it, but don't make them expect it all the time. Reward people with it. You want your best people to be paid the highest. And that's because the most engaged people will give you 3 times the productivity as somebody that's disengaged. 3 times. They'll give you a day and a half of work for 1 day of pay. And somebody that's disengaged gives you a half a day of work for a full day of pay. So reward those people with the time and a half. You know why? Because they're already earning it. Get the poor performers out. All right, so prime cost, go ahead.
I'll let you get back to that in just 1 second. Any advice on planning for a tourist season interrupted by fires and smoke?
Oh, geez. Let's hope there's no smoke this year and we get away with it. But there has to be a contingency plan, and that goes back to that blind staffing grids. So let's say that you're a busy restaurant and you plan for $100,000 a week, and then the smoke rolls in and you're like, we're going to be lucky to do 50 this week. You pull out that staffing grid, you restaff it on that, you communicate back out. If it's an ongoing issue, if it's going to last a couple of months, maybe you move people on to work in Washington where they can get a little bit of overtime, or not overtime, but unemployment pay, while getting paid for the other hours that they're working without losing them. But that is absolutely disastrous to have that happen, especially in the middle of summer. And we've not had great luck. Last year was a little bit better, but we've not had great luck the previous 4 or 5 years before that. It sets in. But that's a hard question. But back to the blind staffing, here's how we adjust. And but having a plan for it is really a good idea to say, hey, remember at the beginning of the pandemic, there was this whole option of Work Washington where we had to cut people's hours, but they could get part of it back by being on unemployment with the state, as long as they were guaranteed to get, I think, 20 hours a week or something. I'm not an expert in that area, but I thought it was a really fantastic, fantastic program put in place. All right, on to prime cost. The most important number on your P&L is the highest impact for driving profitability. So it's really taking your sales minus your gross margin. And one of the greatest restaurateurs that I ever worked with said the major breakthrough for him, and this is a smart dude, and he said that one of the major breakthroughs, Rick, that I ever did is look at prime cost as one number. not cost of goods sold and labor, but one number. If I make this pan of this, what's my labor cost on the backside? What's my product cost on the front? And can I sell it for 50-55%? So really looking at the whole, then breaking the parts apart, looking at the margin, the cost, the efficiency. So what is your number? It should be close to 60. Hopefully it's 55. You get to 55, you're rolling out your brand all day, I'll tell you that much. So that's the magic number, is 55%. But keeping it as close to 60 in Washington State, I think, is a win. And the reason that you have to have it at 60 is there's about 30% below that number at a minimum. About 30% at a minimum. So you look at your operating costs, always going to be around, 6 to 8%, could be as low as 4. But, let's say 4 to 8% there. Comps and marketing, 2-3% there at the minimum. I've lumped comps in there along with the promotions and marketing, but that's about right. Your G&A, probably 4 to 5% now, because your credit card discounts have come up. That's what I've got in G&A. Toast is taking the world by storm, but unfortunately, they get those credit card fees rolling in. And we've got a lot of signature cards and stuff right now. So that G&A number is really closer to 5 now than 3. This just happens to be a super high volume restaurant with a lot of cash. So they don't have a lot of, the credit card fees are lower than 2. So then they don't have a lot of expenses on top of that. And then utilities, 2 to 3%, pretty typical. So if you look at that, you get your, down to controllable profit. And that's the one that most managers in the industry are judged by, that NEBO number. You get that NEBO number below 20%, you're not going to make any money. You're not going to return anything back. You look at occupancy at 9%. Hopefully your profit sharing, you've got at least 1 to 2% in bonuses, a little bit of interest, maybe professional fees, a point or so, and then depreciation, which really generally is about the same as your CapEx. So we want to keep going on that. So this controllable profit number, you really want it to be close to about 25 to 30%. And that is very difficult to do in Washington State with the labor the way it is, but it can be done. We have it all over the place in our portfolio. It can be done, but it's by managing every 15 minutes of the restaurant, having that business out in front of you, purchasing correctly, so on and so forth.
A question from the audience. They're looking for input on how to structure manager bonuses. Is it just based on prime cost? And what would you include from controllables?
Yeah, so I like the prime cost result, and then I tie it to sales. So I like to just budget 1% of sales. In this case, they're doing pretty well, so they went above and beyond because they've got some people above the store that they were incentivizing. But I like to have, provided that you've got enough sales, if you've got a $1 million restaurant, 1% of sales is going to be a little bit tough, but it's still $10,000. But I like to tie it to sales. I like to have sales increases and then managing your prime cost, whatever that goal is. And it's going to be different by location. So managing your prime cost is really what the managers can control. And then there's some things that, we want to keep an eye on, like repairs and maintenance, that, you don't have those being too low, that you're not too high as well. So I like the controllable profit number, but the real big driver of that is your prime cost. And that really simplifies things. You just say, hey, beat your 60% prime cost. And keep your sales, increase sales over prior year, or at least 95% of prior year, and keep the building in good repair, and making sure that you keep your stars up. So I use the 5 P's. I use, how are your people doing? How's your plan going? Your forecasting, how accurate are you on there? How's your profit? How's your property? And then how do the guests feel about your patrons? So those are the 5 P's that I use. But I would say that four out of five of them are the expectation of your job, whether you're going to keep your job or not as a manager. So, you know, you drop below four stars on Yelp and your social media scores, your sales are going to go down. Direct correlation there. People don't look for anything below four stars. You're going to drop off, especially your new guests. Remember, 20 to 40% of your guests are brand new. And guess how they find you? Either they're word of mouth or they're going on Yelp. They've heard something and they go on and they check out your reviews. So you drop below four stars, your sales are going to go down. According to Harvard, they did a big study, especially in the city of Seattle, 9-point drop if you go down one star, 9 points. So it's important. So four stars or better on your social media scores is a minimum. So that would be one of the things that I looked at. But again, that's part of your job. So part of it is doing your job, managing this controllable profit, managing your prime costs is where it really is above and beyond, because it takes a lot of effort, forecasting, extra time, filling in shifts, running the front desk if you got cut short. So there's a lot of things that I use, but prime cost is going to be one of the easiest things to judge and the easiest way to set up. So positive same store sales growth, prime cost at whatever level you can. Because if you're serving pasta, obviously your prime cost should be better because pasta is cheap, or pizza should be better. Pizza's cheap. Selling steak, going to be a little bit worse.
All right. We have a few more questions, but I want to make sure you complete your presentation before we get to those. So also, if anybody does need to drop off, they can watch the rest of this online later on today. So
great. Awesome. So just kind of running through the rest of it, you want your occupancy to be, you know, less than 10%. And that'll be your trip, your triple nets, your rent, your property taxes, parking, liability insurance. And then getting down to the bottom, we want to make sure that we do keep an eye on this depreciation and amortization, because it does generally run about the same amount as your CapEx. CapEx, capital expenditures, don't hit your income statement. They're on your balance sheet as fixed assets. So we, even though people talk about EBITDA, we still need to pay attention to that depreciation and amortization, because that's going to approximate what your CapEx is going to be. Stuff that doesn't hit your income statement, but it hits your cash flow. So we want to keep an eye on that at all times. All right, so just finishing up, make sure you compete for margin every single day. Clean financial statements, make sure your inventory is in line. Compare to comparable periods, so look at prior year, look at prior months. Analyze your sales mix every day, and sales cures a multitude of sins, so just keep figuring out how to drive those to those five buckets. Take prime costs as a unit first, drive your controllable profit, reward handsomely your crew that does a great job, set 10% as a break even and accept nothing less. Otherwise, you're not going to get any return on your investment. All right.
Sorry about that, was muted. Regarding the prime calculation, total labor includes all management, payroll taxes, and above unit admin payroll?
It depends if you, usually I don't put the, let's say that you had five restaurants and you had a director of ops with those five restaurants and you're splitting that expense. I don't put that, typically I don't put that into prime cost. I put that down, what we call the 9,000s below the line, because it's support costs. It's really a support. And we expect those people that are working above store, above location, are getting better results through that location, as opposed to just chewing up money.
What is your suggestion regarding the COLA increases in minimum wage in this state? They cannot automate everything, and it's not sustainable. I feel like we're planning year by year and praying for a lower increase from LNI.
Yeah, and you're not going to get a lower increase. It just keeps going up and up and up. And unfortunately, the guest is really tired of price increases. That was one of the things that came out of the restaurant finance nationally. conference in November is they said the guest is kind of done with price increases. So now it has to be about building the check average naturally through increased beverage sales, appetizers, desserts, all of those things, capturing all the sales that you can to drive check average, because this state will drive you out of business. They'll continue to increase everything. And that whole, you know, somebody brought up unemployment tax there, that's going to continue to go up for the next couple of years too. It's all built in to, you know, he wanted to massively increase the unemployment tax. We got notices saying that it's 5%. 5%. I mean, it went up like 10 times. And we had to go back and negotiate a different deal, but it will continue to climb over the years. So driving that check average and getting more productive, managing your sales per labor hour, managing your food sales per labor hour, managing every 15 minutes, keeping inventory to a minimum so you can speed up and maximize your management time as well as maximize your cash. Those are all critical things in the future because it is not sustainable. Bad news and the good news is everybody knows it's not sustainable and we're going to lose a lot of restaurants. $1 million restaurant's going to have a really hard time making it in the state. Just, you know, with a $70,000 manager, going to be 100.
Can you say the five P's again?
Oh, five P's. So thanks for the test. property is one of them. So taking care of your facility, planning. That's your forecasting, your accuracy, all of that kind of stuff, goals, setting goals, profit, people, which are your people, making sure that their reviews are done on time, that your retention. That's a huge key to the future because people that stick around longer are more productive. You'll make more money if you keep your staff. And then your patrons, which are your guests. It's the balance scorecard.
This next question, I've recently moved from a GM to a multi-unit administrator. What's the best way to report to my owners salient information? Are there templates you have available? What's the best way to distill all the information from the various restaurants so I can quickly present where we are?
Yeah, stay high. Don't get caught into produce, dairy, around food costs. Here's food costs, here's beverage costs. If they want to ask what's going on with beverage, at least you can have it there. Here's the operating expenses, G&A, so on and so forth. So keep them in those big buckets. Don't get too mired in the detail because as soon as you get mired in the detail, they're going to start asking more and more questions and it'll be an endless meeting. So I take, if you look at the P&L here, this would be what I would look at, not all the operating expenses that are in there, right? There's like, I don't know, 25 accounts in this operating expense here, I would just give them a condensed statement like this that's got cost of goods sold, maybe I go food and beverage, maybe not, labor, so on and so forth. If they want more detail, they can ask you for it, but I keep it at a pretty high level for that. And then if you're presenting to a board, it's really easy. You're doing same store sales, you're doing prime costs, and you're doing net income or EBITDA, both probably. And so really condensed like this, nice and tight, big buckets, so that you can control the conversation as opposed to them controlling the conversation with you. You want to look like you're in charge there because you are in charge. And you better improve results too. That's the big thing, year over year. So I would have this year for the period, last year for the period, the variance, this year for the year to date, last year for the year to date, the variance. That's how we report all of that. And if you've got budget, throw them in there with variances as well. But that's where I would go. Keep it big like this. Don't get mired in detail.
All right. Could we get a list of various data points and how they are calculated separately?
Don't know what that means.
All right. If the person who could ask that could type that into the Q&A, we will get to that, but we can move on. What should food cost be for bakery, deli, labor costs, and overhead percentages be? What formula would you use to calculate a sales price for a spreadsheet?
So if you're talking about bakery, having a bakery, bakery cost of goods are typically very low. Their labor is very high. So their cost of goods might be 10 to 15%. Their labor might be 45 to 50 or 40 to 50. So they're completely different than a restaurant. A bakery is, if you're speaking specifically about a bakery. And then spreadsheet-wise, it's as simple as having your best sellers listed in a spreadsheet with the cost and then plugging in. I always like to use annual data because then I can say, okay, if I move this one particular product by a dollar and I sold 10,000 of them last year, I'm going to move my profitability up by $10,000 and offset any increase in product cost. The other thing is that why I like the big data like that is because what I call the turkey burger, which is, you know, years ago, looking at, you know, the owner loved the turkey burger, but she sold like 11 a year and they were all to her. So we want to make sure we avoid the turkey burger. It's a great product, but it doesn't sell. Get it off the menu. Too many other things to run.
Right. And for from the last question, she means, for example, the data points on how Prime is calculated and the other various line items on a P&L.
Okay. So that would be a full P&L, what's on the full P&L. But the Prime cost really is the total cost of goods plus total labor, all the different various points. If they need kind of a chart of accounts, if you need kind of a chart of accounts, of what goes into those things, I'm more than willing to provide that. Not a big deal. I can send that directly out. But you can see on the labor, this is kind of how we break it down, you know, cooks, prep, dishwasher, front desk, wait staff, so on and so forth for all of these different categories. That's how we break down labor. And then food is gonna, I guess I didn't do the food one, but that would have bakery, dairy, meat, seafood, the different accounts that comprise usually about seven of those. More than willing to provide those for sure.
And we will have these slides up on our website later on today to help you out if you want to take a look at them later. Rick, are you still good on time? I've got about four more questions in the bin if you want to go ahead and answer them. Or if not, should we have them reach out to you after this?
Yeah, please have them reach out directly. I need to kind of wrap up here, but it's been a pleasure. I love the format of being able to answer things as we go along.
Rick, I did have one question from the slides earlier. You talked about building incremental sales versus for helping increase the ticket prices. How do you manage that with understaffing issues that so many restaurants are being faced with these days?
Yeah, that's a tough one. If they're understaffed, we have to ask the other people to do more. So, you know, can the host, when they seat you, take your beverage order? And, you know, can people come out of the kitchen and help bus tables, provided they have a clean apron to put on? So really getting the entire team involved. And if they're understaffed, unfortunately, they're going to have to cut down the size of the restaurant. Because you don't want to disappoint the guests. They just won't come back. If they're just sitting there waiting, they're just not going to come back. Now, that's one of the things you can take away from Olive Garden is they control the guest. I don't like it as a guest, but they only staff to what they have. I mean, they seat you when they can seat you. They're not going to disappoint you at the table.
Yeah, and I noticed that we're going to have to miss on some of the questions that are on the in the queue there. However, I just want a reminder, Rick is with the advisory network. And so every restaurant, every hotel, every member of the association has 30 minutes of Rick's time. So some of you have very specific questions. Please reach out to your advisor or to reach out to your area coordinator and set up a time, or territory manager, to set up a time with Rick. And Rick is just one of close to a dozen advisors that we have. So legal, property management, leasing, all those types of things are also there. But with Rick, I know that there's some specific questions here. Please reach out to your territory managers and schedule that free 30-minute session with Rick.
Thank you so much, Rick. We really appreciate the time that you donated to us. Like I said earlier, we have recorded this. This will be up on our website later on today, along with the slides, which include Rick's contact information. Also, like Lex just said, please reach out to your territory manager if you would like a 30-minute consultation. Thank you so much. And everybody
awesome. Have a great day. Thanks, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the Washington Hospitality Industry Podcast. Make sure to visit our website, wahospitality.org, where you can learn more about the restaurant and lodging industries and the Washington Hospitality Association. Be sure to subscribe to the show in iTunes, Google, Spotify, or iHeartRadio so you'll never miss a show. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes. Thank you so much for that effort. Until next time.